I've decided to reflect on my career as a teacher. This is my 46th year, as mentioned before. One more than Dwayne, but the same as Jerry Yoder. But this year will be my last. People often say in transitions that they're leaving to spend time with a family. But that's true for me. I want to spend some quality time with Laurel, knowing that health and wellness is not always a given. So as I reflect on how I ended up doing this vocation, this is my story. I was born in the middle of the 50s, part of that baby boom generation. And I'm an identical twin. We're mirror images. I'm left-handed, he's right-handed, and we look a lot alike. My grandfather never could tell us apart. He just called us the twins. But we were born on my older brother's second birthday. So there are three of us in the family with a birthday on the same day. So I never had my own birthday and had to share it with two other brothers. But sometimes my mom was creative. She made, I remember one time, a train cake. So, you know, my older brother, he got the engine. And I was in the middle, so I was 5 minutes older than my twin, so I got the middle car. And then my younger twin got the caboose. My younger brother then joined us 5 years after, so there were four boys in the family, and my mom had her hands full. For the first year of my life, we lived on the third floor of the Mennonite Publishing House where my dad was employed. And I can just imagine my mom, who was not a big person, 5'2", and we lived on the third floor, so I can imagine having me in one arm and my twin in the other arm, and then coaxing a two-year-old up and down the three flights of stairs. I think it must have been exhausting for her. My dad built a house in the country about 3.5 miles out of town, but it was mostly built by other Mennonite men who were much handier than he was. Dad tells the story that they hit bedrock quite quickly as they were digging the basement. And so they went to the hardware store, which apparently you could in those days, and bought dynamite. But they apparently used a little bit too much, and the blast was quite tremendous. But I spent the next 16 years of my life in this house. But I always felt growing up in the country was quite idyllic. There were five of other Mennonite families kind of in the same general area. So it was a little bit like a Mennonite ghetto. With three other brothers and a bunch of neighborhood kids, there was much to do. Baseball, swimming in Hernley's Lake. I can remember on hot days just sinking down to the bottom and sticking my feet in that cold, cool mud. And then fishing and ice skating on that same lake, catching crayfish in a small stream. We used to build a little crayfish corral and then see how many crayfish we could put in there in an hour or so. And then, of course, riding bikes all over the place. Our mom didn't always know where we were, but she did know that we would be home for lunch and supper. All of us attended Southmoreland School District, the local public school, and there was no busing for kindergartners, so we never attended kindergarten. Our family had only one car, and it didn't seem terribly necessary for us to go to kindergarten, but that made first grade all the more difficult. I remember it all these years later. It was terrible. I had a hard time sitting that long in my seat. Can you imagine sitting for 6 hours in a seat? So I remember getting out, crawling around on the floor, just trying to move a little bit, and then Mrs. Crowshaw caught me, and I was banished to the hallway. Actually, it wasn't so bad. I could run up and down the hallway and do some things like that. But I spent quite a bit of time in the hallway that year. Our family always liked books. They were always around. My dad went to the University of Pitt Seminary to get his doctor's degree and had a class in the evening once or twice a week. And once a week, he would go to the Carnegie Library, that's the biggest of them all, and check out books for us. I remember it was like Christmas every week. We would race to see what he brought to us in the morning, and they were laid out in four different piles, three or four books each. And then, of course, we'd read our books first, but then we'd, of course, read the other books as well. I remember my dad took to standing while he read his books because if he sat down, somebody would pile into his lap and ask him to read to us. But it seemed like my vocation would involve reading in some way because that really was important growing up. I remember in fourth grade, a guest speaker came to class and shared a slide presentation that captured the route General Braddock took to Pittsburgh to challenge the French. Some of you might know that there was a young man by the name of George Washington along in that one. But I saw wagon tracks in the fields 200 years after the fact. And I thought that was pretty impressive. Dad also liked history, so we took family trips to places like Fort Necessity and Jamonville. And I think this was the beginning of a spark of interest, because I recall sitting at times and trying to imagine, so what happened 100 years earlier on this spot that I'm sitting, and then maybe 200 years? In my junior year of high school, 1972, the Vietnam War was still raging. In our small Mennonite Youth Fellowship, or MYF, we discussed ways to respond. The 10 or so Mennonites in a school of about 800 were pretty insignificant. However, some were aware that Mennonites were pacifists, and that wasn't particularly popular in Scottsdale, where they tended to be quite conservative and patriotic, even so today. And my twin brother and I tried to think about how to respond. And we decided to choose not to say the Pledge of Allegiance that was required each day in school. We were simply going to stand respectfully, but not say anything during that particular time. Surprisingly, as I look back today, we didn't talk about this with our parents before we did it. Maybe we thought they wouldn't necessarily approve. I'm not sure. But it only took one day for my homeroom teacher to see that I wasn't saying the Pledge of Allegiance. He sent me to the principal, who happened to be an ex-Marine. And he was rather flabbergasted that I would choose not to say the Pledge of Allegiance. I told him that I have a higher authority that I will pledge allegiance to and not to a country. And then I suppose this was a smart teenage response. I also said I would find it difficult to pledge allegiance to a country that was napalming human beings in Vietnam. He didn't like that very much. And he said he would call my dad. I said, I think that's a good idea. And when he called my dad, who said he would support me if my conscience dictated not saying the pledge, the principal couldn't figure that one out. But my brother and I had done our research. The courts had said persons could not be coerced in saying the pledge, and I think the principal knew that. So he sent me back to class, no doubt with some gnashing of teeth, and my brother and I didn't say the Pledge of Allegiance in school again. But I had a history teacher by the name of Mr. Siegel. He was short, he was funny, but he was very knowledgeable, and I learned many things from him. Like the Empress of China, Su Xi, never cut her fingernails, and they curled all around. I thought, that's cool. But one of the things that I remember most was his history club. We got purple t-shirts with the motto, Historiae et Veritas ad nauseam. History and truth till it makes you sick. We didn't do much. But I remember one time going to the cemetery and looking at gravestones to speculate about history. I think he was certainly an influence in my vocational direction. And as high school drew to a close, my twin and I never really considered going someplace different. We had always been together, so we considered our college options together. And as I often tell my own students, in my whole life, I've never had my own room, something which is very foreign to them. But Dad was dangling the prospect of paying 50% of the tuition if we attended a Mennonite college. And the options at that time were EMC, Goshen, and Heston. So many students today want to be close to home, but my brother and I felt like maybe distance was going to be a good thing. So we chose Heston in Kansas, of all places. And when we walked on the campus in the fall of 73, that was the first time we had ever been on campus. Sometimes students tell me they make 5 visits before they decide on a campus today, so maybe things are different. But Heston was a good fit for me. It was small enough to try many different things. I played soccer, ran track, and took all kinds of classes. But I think my favorite class was taught by Jim Minninger, and it was called The History of the American West. He was sort of a funny guy, but also quite encouraging. We read quite a few books in that class that were required, but I didn't mind. I found them quite interesting. It was fascinating, for example, to connect with the history of Newton, Kansas, one of those early cow towns in 1871 that had its own Bloody Sunday. And as I recall, there were a number of those showdowns in this rowdy town with saloons and bawdy houses. That's interesting reading. It was the fall of 73 that I met Laurel. She's going to have to share her own story sometime, so I don't want to tell her journey, but our first date was one when she and her friend approached my twin and I, who were eating dinner in the cafeteria. It was that weekend, called Flirp Weekend, where girls were supposed to ask the guys out, which is probably good, because some guys never get around to that. And they said, "Do you want to go out with them?" And my brother and I, we looked at each other and we said, "Well, who's supposed to go with whom?" And they looked at us and they said, "We can't tell you apart. You figure it out." So when we got back to the dorm, Jer and I both wanted to go with Laurel. Oh, that was a problem. So I pulled out a quarter and we decided to flip. I won. And the rest is history. In the spring of my sophomore year at Heston, I started wondering about the next step. It seems a little late, perhaps, but you know, you just enjoy college while it's happening. But the bad thing of a 2-year college is that you have to figure out what to do after 2 years. My track coach, I recall, pushed me to consider what my next step should be. I can recall one practice when we were running repeat quarters. We do a quarter mile and then do a little recovery. And he said, "What classes do you like best?" As I was doing my 15-second recovery, just like that. And I said, I think history. So I ran another quarter. And when I got back, he said, "Well, you can do 2 things with history. You can either teach or you can be an archivist." So I ran another lap. I thought about that. It seemed to me that, you know, I had allergies, and in spending time in dusty libraries reading old books didn't appeal nicely to me in libraries, so I said, maybe teaching. So I decided really at that point to go and pursue education, the next step being, again, my father's 50% tuition discount at Goshen. And pursued education there. Now, I had to catch up a little bit because education component is on top of a regular major. And so I took my SST, study service trimester, or term it's called now, in the summer. I went to the country of Belize, formerly called British Honduras, and spent 3 months there. And my service assignment was being a teacher's aide in a school there. I got to watch corporal punishment up front and in person, and it was not pretty. I saw a number of kids come back the next day with bruises on the back of their legs where they had been smacked because they missed too many math problems by their teacher. So that indeed reminded me that something is not what I want to do. My student teaching was done in the fall of my senior year in a junior high school in Elkhart, Indiana, which essentially was an urban area. The student population was 50% African American, about 25% Hispanic, and 25% white. So I had to learn how to teach in a setting like that, in addition to learn how to teach. So it was challenging. It really was the hardest work I had ever done up to that point. And I remember Laurel giving me an early Christmas present that year. I was struggling to compile grades, so she gave me a calculator. Some of you might recall in those days that was quite dramatic, you know, big and clunky and expensive, but it really was great. She really knows how to give gifts. If you want an idea, she knows how to figure it out very nicely. Laurel came with me to Goshen, and she got a job in the registrar's office and took classes part-time because she was uncertain about her next step. So we got married between our junior and senior year in college. My parents thought it's a bit young and hasty, but Laurel's parents had actually been married earlier than that, so they thought it was okay. And we've been together 47 years, so I guess it sort of worked. As graduation approached, I sent out 60 resumes to school all around Goshen, as well as several other areas. I never got any interviews, but one, Paul Miller, who was principal at Christopher Dock Mennonite High School, was doing some recruiting for a variety of faculty positions. Christopher Dock at that time was expanding, needed more teachers. And so I had an interview with him, and his first question was, "Are you related to the editor of the Gospel Herald?" I think this was the only time in my life that was probably a helpful question. But it seemed like the rest of the interview was kind of a given. I got a call a week later and was offered the job, and I accepted a day or so later after Laurel and I processed the idea of moving to eastern Pennsylvania, where we had no relatives. It seemed like an adventure, but fraught with lots of questions. Dwayne Kaufman wrote me a personal letter. I lost it. When we were moving the first time, I had found it, but I forget where I put it now. So I will find that someday in his distinctive handwriting style. But in that letter, I remember he was welcoming to school, and he said, "I like it here, and I think you will too." It actually was very helpful to get that letter before my first year of teaching. First year of teaching was as advertised, just work. Just work. Much of it is a blur, but I do remember that sense of relief that I had as the school year ended. And with that break, I thought, well, I can make it another year with some time off in the summer. The assumption in those days for a doc teacher was that they would attend a Mennonite church. So we lived in Lansdale at the time and attended Plains Mennonite Church twice, and they thought we were going to go there. They even asked us to be MYF leaders. However, that wasn't what we intended. We did get plugged into Percocet through Ken and Becky Horst and found several young families on the same journey we were. And I think one of the attractions to Percocet was the makeup of the congregation contained a lot of transplants to this particular area instead of, what should we say, indigenous populations. A year or two later, we were asked again to be MYF sponsors, which we did, a job though we didn't feel prepared for either. Our first child was born in 1982, our second in 84, and our third in 86. First two were boys, and I found fatherhood something I enjoyed, but also call those moments the fog years due to sleep deprivation. As my ninth year of teaching ended, I was told I was eligible for sabbatical. I had ideas of going to Heston College to teach, but then told I wasn't needed there. And then at that point, we discovered Laurel was pregnant with our third child, and we wondered what we were going to do. I had a desire to do a service-related assignment, but this new kid was a bit of a problem. But we were told of an opportunity in Brownsville, Texas, and Laurel courageously said she'd be willing to go and was even willing to give birth in a new town with a new doctor and all that kind of stuff. We went, and I ended up teaching in a public school for my service assignment, and our daughter was born in November. There were lots of interesting things we encountered in a culture that was distinctly different than ours. We made a number of sojourns into Mexico and got used to wonderful, freshly made tortillas off the tortilla press. and ate on a rather Spartan food budget, which included lots of beans and rice. But I was pushed professionally as I taught at a large public school where English was usually a second language for most students. We were told we had to teach in English. We couldn't, not that I knew Spanish, but it was something that they wanted students to hear only English. But I had to get used to a public school culture because I had never taught there before. Much of the school seemed to be quite regimented compared to my doc experience. Students did not seem to be trusted. But perhaps in large settings, it's easier to maintain that sense of order. But I never quite felt comfortable with that. I know several of my students were Mexican and literally crossed the river every day to go to school looking for a better education than what they had in Mexico. Brownsville is right on the border, literally from Mexico there. The law said that all students needed to be educated if they could produce an address where they lived in the United States. They did not have to be citizens. And since the district was large, it was not possible to track all students, and some, of course, were not legitimately in the United States. We learned much about border issues and immigration when we were there. But regardless of the citizenship, nearly 90% of my students would have spoken Spanish as their primary language. English comprehension was very difficult for many. So I discovered I needed to teach differently. Texas has some very particular things that are required to be taught. The textbook was large, and it was quite dull, and it was hard for a lot of Spanish language learners to read and to understand. So I often read it to students, and then I used some of the material to tell stories. My tests tended to be vocabulary tests, and I felt like that was most helpful for my students at that point in their life experience. I tried not to fail students, feeling that that's not going to be particularly useful. Many other teachers at the school would fail scores of students, and again, the language comprehension often was the barrier there. It seemed to me, though, that students were learning something, and I should give them credit for that rather than having to experience failure all over again. It was valuable as a teacher to have that experience, and it created a sense of confidence, I believe, in the classroom when I returned to doc that I had not had before. A year or so after we returned from Brownsville, I was asked to consider the administrative role of assistant principal for 1 year. I was often up for something new, so I tried it. It seemed that in addition to discipline, the role often expanded to include things the principal didn't want to do or didn't feel like she had time to do. And the interim became permanent when the principal changed. So I did the job for 7 years, and some pieces of the job did seem to be a fit. I enjoyed working at technology and curriculum, and worked at the master schedule with some new software that seemed to work pretty well. However, the drudge of that discipline stuff seemed unending. The lack of parental support and seeing those same students over and over again began to wear on me. I did an interim middle school principal job at Penn View during a sabbatical year and then returned to doc as an interim principal before deciding it was time to return to the classroom. And I went back in the 99-2000 school year. And it felt to me as I went back to the classroom, this is much more fun. I could interact with all students instead of just a few special ones. I could shout, I could sing, I could jump all over. I taught that senior Bible class that worked at non-resistance and reconciliation, and I could share my pledge story with students and challenge them to consider who they are and whose they are. I also taught several social studies classes, and my load increased when Duane retired then. And I was blessed with a number of like-minded colleagues in my department, and we've worked at educational shifts together. Collaborative learning became significant in the 21st century, as did teaching as a guide on the side rather than the sage on the stage. And instead of rows of chairs, I have tables for groups of four. Our schedule changed from 40-minute periods to blocks of 90 minutes. And this, of course, necessitated teaching a number of different things in that 90-minute period. I don't suppose in the last 15 years I've done more than a 15-minute lecture. Technology, from desktop computers to everyone having an iPad, was also part of the change. But after 5 years of iPads, we're shifting to Chromebooks because there's less distraction. Smartphones, of course, have become ubiquitous. We've gone from seeing them occasionally in the classrooms to students being mesmerized with them continually. And so this year, to combat the inattentiveness in the classroom, we've mandated pockets, places where students will pocket their phone at the beginning of the period and pick them up at the end. I think it has helped some. During the pandemic, we were required to Zoom and teach in person at the same time, and that about did me in. If I was closer to retirement then, that would have been it. But I felt good about some of the changes that we worked at school. After an accreditation year, the question was often raised, what makes your Mennonite school distinct? I was challenged by that. And so we worked at developing a conflict resolution class required for all juniors. It meant there was less direct history time, but it seemed an appropriate trade-off for a Mennonite school. In addition, we've developed a trip to Philadelphia that takes advantage of our historical setting. If you haven't visited the Powell House yet, it's well worth your time. Unless I wrap up the story of my vocation, I struggled to keep this to 20 or 25 minutes. I wanted to tell you other stories that represent other aspects of my life that are even more important, such as my family. But I can tell students in my classes about being a father, what it's like to have your own children in class and in school, and many other family things. But that may have to wait for another day. I was reminded as this school year began of how much energy it takes to do the job. Laurel sometimes will tell me when I get home, before you take your nap, can you do this? It does feel like the time is ready to move on. And Dwayne's letter, before I began teaching, suggested he thought I would enjoy myself at Doc. He was right. It was a great way to spend my life's work.